Does Frank's financial sheet alibi add up? In his trial statement, Leo Frank spent much of his time trying to prove that he was so engrossed in preparing a complex weekly financial form on the afternoon of April 26th that he could not have had time to commit the murder and do all that was required to conceal the body and clean up the murder scene. Beyond his reliance on the repugnant, quote, Negro crime, end quote, defense, this financial sheet remained Frank's only stated alibi. On its face, it has many weaknesses, among them the fact that there were no witnesses to him completing the financial form. Nor was it ever established that there was any real urgency for Frank to complete the task by day's end, or that there was any consequence if he failed. Would a Sunday delivery of the financial sheet to the company's majority shareholder, Sig Montag, and stockholder Oscar Pappenheimer be a career-ending misstep? Pappenheimer testified that he was not expecting to see it until Monday morning, and Montag did not actually see the form until Monday afternoon. In any event, police did not confiscate the forms in their initial investigation, so there is no way of verifying that the forms placed in evidence at the trial were indeed the same ones Frank claimed to have prepared on the day of the murder. Before it became so central to his afternoon activity, Frank let slip, under oath, at the coroner's inquest, that the financial sheet takes about, quote, an hour and a half, end quote, for him to complete. During trial, an accountant testified that the task would require about 2.5 hours to complete. Either way, Frank's dedication to this weekly duty did not seem overly burdensome for an energetic manager with years of experience. And there was another event Frank planned on that day that undermined his alibi's believability. Frank had made plans with his brother-in-law to go to an Atlanta Crackers baseball game, which was set to start at 4 p.m., but he canceled. He said, at first, because of the weather. His testimony at the coroner's inquest was as follows. Coroner, quote, did you intend to go to the ball game on Saturday? End quote. Leo Frank, quote, yes, until I got up and saw it was a cloudy day. End quote. In other words, Frank was claiming that his decision to cancel his game plans was made in the early morning, long before Mary Fagan's murder at about noon. But Frank did not phone his brother-in-law, Charles Ersenbach, to cancel their outing until 1:30 p.m. Thus, no one could corroborate Frank's claim to an early Saturday change of plans, and prosecutors used the 1:30 call to show Frank's panicky post-murder behavior. At the trial, Frank gave a different reason for canceling. I, quote, called up my brother-in-law to tell him that, on account of some work I had to do at the factory, I would be unable to go with him, end quote. If Frank came to work expecting to go to the baseball game, he would have planned to finish working on the financial sheet in the morning so that his afternoon would be free. Thus, Frank had to establish that his decision not to go was made early in the day so that his delaying that work until the afternoon could be justified. Frank, therefore, had to downplay his bad weather excuse and emphasize an overwhelming workload that caused him to toil on the financial sheet late into the afternoon. And for this, he would have to get the support of his 20-year-old, quote, chief clerk and first assistant, end quote, Herbert Schiff, who on the witness stand had a very contentious exchange with prosecutor Hugh Dorsey. Schiff was referring to the financial report when he claimed, quote, we couldn't make it up until Saturday afternoon, end quote. But under a withering cross-examination, Schiff acknowledged that Leo Frank could have finished the factory's financial sheet the morning of the murder. And further, he established that Frank, quote, could have done all of the work in 2.5 hours, end quote. Hardly the all-day grind that Frank portrayed. There was yet more that Herbert Schiff offered that whittled away at Frank's alibi. Frank claimed he was expecting Schiff to come down to the factory to help him complete the financial sheet. That claim was critical to Frank's alibi, because the prosecutor was arguing that Frank had pre-planned the Saturday meeting with Mary Fagan, and was thus trying to clear the factory so that he would have the privacy he needed to isolate and pressure her into a sexual encounter. Frank claimed that to complete his financial report, he needed sales data that only Schiff could supply. So Frank had to show that he was trying to get Schiff to come to the office. If he could prove that point, it would destroy the state's pre-planned encounter theory. Schiff never made it to the factory that day, but a closer look at the interaction between Frank and Schiff's household reveals yet more of the kind of, quote, Negro testimony, end quote, that vexed the Leo Frank defense. According to Frank's own trial statement, quote, I told Alonzo Mann, the office boy, to call up Mr. Schiff and find out when he was coming down. And Alonzo told me the answer came back over the telephone that Mr. Schiff would be right down. So I didn't pay any more attention to that part of the work because I expected Mr. Schiff to come down any minute. End quote. But when the 13-year-old office boy was questioned at trial, his recollection diverged from his boss's account. Quote, I telephoned him, but the girl answered the phone and said he hadn't got up yet. End quote. He did not claim to have relayed any message at all to, quote, the girl, end quote, about Schiff's coming down to the factory, or about the financial sheet, or about any other business. One might just as easily interpret Mann's account as evidence that Frank only wanted to know Schiff's whereabouts so that he could be sure that Schiff would not interrupt his plans with Mary Fagan. Adding weight to that hypothesis is Alonzo Mann's clear statement. Quote, I telephoned once, end quote, which would suggest that there was no urgency and that Schiff's no-show at the factory was a non-issue for Frank. Quote, the girl, end quote, Mann referred to was Schiff's black, quote, servant, end quote, of 7 years, Emma Beard, and her, quote, Negro testimony, end quote, seemed to corroborate Frank's statement that Mann called twice, at 10:30 and 11 o'clock a.m., and under oath, she added, quote, I answered the telephone. It was about 10:30. It sounded like a boy's voice. It said, tell Mr. Schiff Mr. Frank wanted him at the office. Mr. Schiff was asleep at the time. I waked him up and he said, tell Mr. Frank I will be there as soon as I can get dressed. And I repeated the message to the boy and told him what Mr. Schiff said. Then Mr. Schiff went back to sleep again. End quote. This, of course, supports Leo Frank's version. On the second call at 11 o'clock a.m., she said the words were the same. But on cross-examination, Ms. Beard, who just said she had, quote, waked him up, end quote, concluded her testimony thus, quote, on Saturdays and holidays, Mr. Schiff generally sleeps. Sometimes he goes to the factory when I wake him up. He never gets up unless I wake him. Mr. Schiff told me sometime afterwards he was glad I did not wake him up that day. End quote. Ms. Beard let slip the probable truth that Schiff was in bed to stay, that he had no intention of working that Saturday, and that Alonzo Mann, whose truthfulness would become a major element of the case many years later, did not even ask him to come in. And while Frank's attorneys must have been floored by the black woman's inconvenient truthfulness, the prosecutors apparently missed this opportune chance to explode Frank's alibi. Further, Schiff conflicts with his own, quote, servant, end quote, when he testified, quote, with, end quote, one, quote, exception, I have not missed a single Saturday after the 1st of June, 1912, end quote. Ironically, the, quote, Negro testimony, end quote, by Ms. Emma Beard can be seen as spoiling the many perjuries of the Frank coalition. Ms. Beard did her part to try to keep the alibi together, but in her effort to prove to the court that her boss, Mr. Schiff, was pleased with her actions, she undermined Frank's well-planned defense. The witness for the defense was not the only problem for Frank's, quote, financial sheet, end quote, alibi. The Atlanta Journal recorded an unexplored line in the trial testimony of factory foreman Lemmy Quinn. Lemmy, if we recall, claimed to have visited the factory at 12:20, just a few minutes after Mary Fagan's arrival, where he had a brief conversation with Frank in his office. Both Quinn and Frank suddenly, quote, remembered, end quote, this visit a full week after the murder. Revealed by Frank for the first time at the coroner's inquest, it provided a miraculous alibi. Too miraculous for many who remained deeply suspicious. At Frank's trial, Quinn claimed to have been at the factory office that fateful holiday to collect on a baseball bet with Herbert Schiff. When asked what Frank said to him, Quinn testified that, quote, Frank replied he didn't think Schiff would be down that day, end quote. This is a direct repudiation of Frank's own trial statement. Quote, I expected Mr. Schiff to come down any minute, end quote. Again, prosecutors did not pick up the obvious implications of this friendly fire from Quinn. But there is yet another wrinkle in Frank's carefully woven tale. The entire story may have been entirely fabricated. The defense counsel, Reuben Arnold, placed into evidence a timeline that Frank claimed was followed on the day of the murder. It shows that Frank left the factory Saturday with plant manager N.V. Darley at 9:40 and returned at 11 o'clock a.m. But Alonzo Mann testified that his first call to Schiff was at 10:30. Frank, stenographer Hattie Hall, and Mann all testify that Frank gave the order to Mann in person, and it was acted upon immediately. Leo Frank, quote, I told Alonzo Mann, the office boy, to call up Mr. Schiff and find out when he was coming down, and Alonzo told me the answer came back over the telephone that Mr. Schiff would be right down, end quote. Hattie Hall. Mr. Frank, quote, had Alonzo Mann telephone, end quote, Schiff, quote, to come over there to do it, but Mr. Schiff didn't come while I was there, end quote. Alonzo Mann, quote, Mr. Frank told me to phone to Mr. Schiff and tell him to come down. I telephoned him, but the girl answered the phone and said he hadn't got up yet. I telephoned once, end quote. According to the defense's own timeline, Leo Frank was not at the pencil factory for any of this alleged Schiff-calling activity. In sum, the evidence, when carefully examined, shows that if this call occurred at all, it was done by a meticulous Leo Frank, who was calling Herbert Schiff to gauge if he might foil his plot to have his way with Mary Fagan. Schiff never came down to the factory on the day of the murder, and that was exactly as Frank had intended. Where did Leo Frank go after the murder? An amateur sleuth knows that the period of time immediately after the crime is critically important, for during that time, evidence can be destroyed or invented. Clothing can be changed, stories can be synchronized, and alibis can be established. If Mary Fagan was murdered shortly after her noon meeting with Frank, as both the prosecution and the defense surmised, then the next hours of activity by the defendant become critical to his alibi. Leo Frank claimed to have left the factory, quote, a trifle after 1 o'clock, end quote, to go home for lunch at 68 East Georgia Avenue, about a mile from the factory, returning to the factory at 3 p.m. But his recollection of his activities during those 2 hours underwent some significant revisions. Frank swore that he had left work at 1 o'clock p.m., arriving at home 20 minutes later. There he ate, smoked a cigarette, and took a nap before leaving to catch a trolley back to the factory. On his return trip, he claims to have watched the Confederate Day parade, spoken to an employee, and stopped to purchase a few cigars before getting back to work. And again, the, quote, Negro testimony, end quote, of Frank's own, quote, servants, end quote, undermines his rendition. Manola McKnight was in the kitchen with her husband, Albert, when Frank arrived, and they remember his visit quite a bit differently. Quote, between 1 and 2 o'clock on Memorial Day, I was at the home of Mr. Frank to see my wife. He came in close to 1:30. He did not eat any dinner. He came in, went to the sideboard of the dining room, stayed there a few minutes, and then he goes out and catches a, end quote, trolley, quote, car. Stayed there, end quote, in the home, quote, about 5 or 10 minutes, end quote. Albert McKnight's eyewitness testimony presents Frank as being so hurried that he skipped eating altogether. McKnight saw no nap taken or cigarettes smoked and saw no apparent point to Frank coming home at all. His wife, Manola, who Frank claimed served the dinner, admitted that Frank ate nothing and only stayed at home for 10 minutes. The next witnesses who claim to have seen Frank in this all-important two-hour time frame create more suspicion than clarity. They verify Frank's version of his movements, but they all are either relatives or close business associates. A cousin and her friends say that they saw Frank on his way to the trolley and talked to him about Benet Brith matters. But Albert McKnight said he watched as Frank caught the trolley and saw no other people interact with him. A cousin named Cohen Loeb rides back into town with him. A factory employee named Rebecca Carson sees Frank not once but twice, a full 30 minutes apart, and amidst a parade-watching crowd of thousands. Another girl, whose father was employed by the Montags, Helen Kearns, sees Frank at a store. Another sees him sitting in the trolley car. All this seemed staged to the solicitor, Hugh Dorsey, who in his closing argument challenged Frank's alibi witnesses. Quote, "Gentlemen, talk to me about sad spectacles. But of all the sad spectacles that I have witnessed throughout this case, I don't know who did it. I don't know who's responsible. And I hope that I'll go to my grave in ignorance of who it was that brought this little," end quote, Kearns, quote, "girl, the daughter of a man that works for Montag," end quote, National Pencil Company owner, quote, "into this case, to prove this alibi for this red-handed murderer, who killed that little girl to protect his reputation among the people of his own race and religion," end quote. What Frank did in that lengthy period directly after the murder of Mary Fagan and before returning to the factory at 3 p.m. is a mystery. In fact, whether he actually returned at that time or before is still in question. Prosecutor Dorsey argued that Frank was anxious to return to meet up with Conley to burn the body, but Conley was a no-show to the planned cremation. So the pressure that Frank must have felt to dispose of a corpse while still adhering inconspicuously to his Saturday routine seemed to be evident in his hasty home visit. Was he concealing evidence, changing clothes, washing up, writing and rewriting the murder notes, trying to establish an alternative trail? His movements have yet to be accounted for, but the disparity in the conflicting accounts given by Frank, his family members, and his, quote, "servants," end quote, raises more questions than answers. Was Mary a stranger to Leo Frank? One of the most significant features of the case, and one that increased police suspicion of Frank, was his claim that he did not know Mary Fagan, that he never conversed with her, and that even her name was unfamiliar to him. Over time, Frank's denials lost value as more and more testimony from factory workers indicated Frank not only knew Mary Fagan, but harbored an infatuation with her that others noticed and commented on. Frank had prepared the weekly time slips, paperwork, and pay envelopes for all the factory's 170 employees and had done the same for Mary Fagan for at least 52 weeks before her death. Frank's own office boy, Alonzo Mann, said he knew Mary Fagan by sight, even though he had only worked at the factory for about 3 weeks. Only three other girls worked with Mary in the second floor metal room, on the same floor as Leo Frank's office, through which Frank had to pass to use the back stairway and the men's room. Frank's employees testified that they had observed Frank talking to Mary on several occasions. Co-worker Grace Hicks testified that, quote, about 2 or 3 times a day, end quote, Frank, quote, would come back to see if the work was being done properly, end quote. When an opportunity arose to shift suspicion onto another factory employee named James Gant, Frank suddenly volunteered that Gant had shown romantic interest in the girl. On the day before the murder, one of Mary's co-workers came to the factory for her own pay and asked Frank for the pay of Mary Fagan, a common practice among the factory employees. The girl, Helen Ferguson, says that Frank, quote, told me that I couldn't get it, that Mary would be there Saturday and she could get it then, all right, end quote. A nuance of Frank's own testimony also shows his familiarity with Mary and indicates that he was indeed expecting her on the day she was murdered. He testified he knew, quote, that the employees would be coming in for their pay envelopes, end quote. So, quote, I had them all in the cash basket beside me to save walking to the safe each time, end quote. Indeed, he only named four who came in. Mary's envelope was there also, or he would have said her visit was a surprise. Clearly, Leo Frank knew the murder victim and expected her arrival on that fateful Saturday afternoon. His denials of this only helped to make him a prime suspect as the Atlanta police built their case. The nerve of Leo Frank. The sheer number of witnesses who testified to Leo Frank's nervousness and suspicious behavior after the murder is remarkable. Prosecutor Hugh Dorsey successfully presented that testimony to the jury as evidence of Frank's, quote, consciousness of guilt, end quote. By contrast, the first suspect, the first employee Leo Frank tried to implicate, the night watchman Newt Lee, was notable for his calmness and composure as he showed police around the murder scene. Plant manager N.V. Darley commented, quote, Newt Lee seemed to be composed when I saw him at the factory, end quote. In fact, of the many black witnesses, none, including James Conley, were ever characterized as, quote, nervous, end quote, as they each went through their ordeals. Below is a list of witnesses and their observations about Leo Frank's nervous behavior after the murder of Mary Fagan. Officer J. N. Starnes. Quote, Mr. Frank appeared to be nervous. This was indicated by his manner of speaking to Mr. Darley. End quote. Factory manager. Quote, he was in a trembling condition. End quote. N.V. Darley, in charge of plant personnel. Quote, when we started to the basement, I noticed his hands were trembling. I observed that he seemed still nervous when he went to nail up the back door. On Monday, when we started down the elevator, Mr. Frank was nervous, shaking all over. I can't say positively as to whether his whole body was shaking or not, but he was shaking. When riding down to the police station from the pencil factory, Mr. Frank was on my knee. He was trembling. End quote. County Officer W.W. Boots Rogers. Quote, Mr. Frank seemed to be extremely nervous. His questions were jumpy. He was rubbing his hands when he came through the curtains, end quote, at his home on the morning of April 27th. Quote, he moved about briskly. He seemed to be excited. He asked questions in rapid succession. Mr. Frank was apparently still nervous at the undertaking establishment. He stepped lively. It was just his general manner that indicated to me that he was nervous. Frank still seemed to be nervous like the first time I seen him. End quote. Officer John R. Black. Quote, his voice was hoarse and trembling and nervous and excited. He looked to me like he was pale. I had met Mr. Frank on two different occasions before. On this occasion, he seemed to be nervous in handling his collar. He could not get his tie tied and talked very rapid in asking questions in regard to what had happened. Mr. Frank was nervous on Monday. End quote. James Gant, former factory clerk. Quote, Mr. Frank looked pale, hung his head, and nervous, and kind of hesitated and stuttered like he didn't like me in there somehow or other. End quote. L.O. Grice, bystander. Mr. Frank, quote, attracted my attention on account of his nervousness. He was kind of shaking like that. Illustrating. His fingers were trembling. End quote. Jim Conley, factory sweeper. Quote, Mr. Frank was standing up there at the top of the steps and shivering and trembling and rubbing his hands like this. He didn't give me time to stop the elevator. He was so nervous and trembly. End quote. He was, quote, trembling and nervous. End quote. Newt Lee, factory night watchman. Quote, he, end quote, Mr. Frank, quote, says, I want to change the slip. It took him twice as long this time than it did the other times I saw him fix it. He fumbled putting it in, while I held the lever for him, and I think he made some remark about he was not used to putting it in. Mr. Gant came from across the street. About that time, Mr. Frank come busting out of the door and run into Gant unexpected, and he jumped back, frightened. End quote. When Frank gave his unsworn statement in court, he addressed the testimony about his nervous behavior in this way. Quote, gentlemen, I was nervous. I was very nervous. I was completely unstrung. I will admit it. Imagine, awakened out of my sound sleep, and a morning run down in the cool of the morning in an automobile driven at top speed, without any food or breakfast, rushing into a dark passageway, coming into a darkened room, and then suddenly an electric light flashed on, and to see the sight that was presented by that poor little child. Why, it was a sight that was enough to drive a man to distraction. That was a sight that would have made a stone melt. And then it is suspicious, because a man who is ordinary flesh and blood should show signs of nervousness. Just imagine that little girl, in the first blush of young womanhood, had had her life so cruelly snuffed out. Might a man not be nervous who looked at such a sight? Of course I was nervous. Any man would be nervous if he was a man. End quote. Frank's explanation has satisfied many of his supporters, even though most of the witness testimonies were about his nervousness observed before he saw the body of, quote, that poor little child, end quote, and before he was accused of any crime. Of course, the many accounts of Frank's unusual nervousness do not in themselves indicate guilt in the murder of Mary Fagan, but they did add a layer of suspicion that Frank found hard to shake. The Murder Notes and Negro Night Witches. Quote, even between these two notes themselves, there is little similarity. You could not testify they were written by the same man. End quote. Reuben Arnold, Leo Frank's attorney. Quote, the nigger says he can't write, and we feel that he can write. I said, I know he can write. End quote. Leo M. Frank. The most peculiar feature of the Mary Fagan murder case is also the most contentious, namely the strange presence of two handwritten messages inscribed on pencil company notepaper and found near the body, in the basement of the factory. The text of the missives had a strange twist. The notes were written as if they were the desperate scrawlings of a young victim in the last throes of death fingering her killer. The first note read, quote, ma'am, that Negro hire down here did this. I went to make water and he pushed me down that hole, a long, tall Negro, black, that who it was, long, slim, tall Negro, I write while play with me. End quote. And the second, quote, he said he would love me and land down play like a night witch did it, but that long, tall, black Negro did by himself. End quote. Frank himself described their significance. Quote, unquestionably, without any gratuitous additions, the person that wrote those two notes killed Mary Fagan. There could be no doubt of that, nor do I think any fair-minded and just person will doubt it. The hand that wrote these two notes tied the cord around poor little Mary Fagan's neck. The study of these notes must show the truth. End quote. Certainly, there are aspects of the notes that are intriguing. including the physical construction, the penmanship, the wording and its meaning, and the fact that they exist at all, and require further examination. From their very discovery by police, who first responded to the emergency call from Newtley, they were seen as an anomaly. The notion that they were authored by the victim was quickly dismissed by investigators as the killer's diversion. The dialect and form of the text seemed to indicate that the writer was black and barely literate. At that time, it must be remembered, it was generally assumed that blacks could not read or write. To white investigators, a, quote, Negro murder, end quote, scene with written notes explaining the murder put the crime in a class by itself. In his revealing testimony, the black factory sweeper, James Conley, maintained, and the all-white jury believed, that he first entered the crime scene when his boss, Leo Frank, ordered him to help transport the dead body of Mary Fagan to the basement. They then returned to Frank's second-floor office, where Frank dictated 4 separate notes while Conley wrote them on notepaper. Conley further elaborated that Frank had ordered him to go down in the basement, gather up some wood chips, put them in the furnace, and place the girl's body on top. If he completed the cremation, Frank told him, he would not leave the notes down in the basement. Conley smelled the coffee at this point and probably figured that if he did return to the factory, Frank may well show up with the police only to find a black man caught in the act of burning the corpse of a white child. Conley opted out, leaving Frank to conceal the body. 2 of those notes would eventually be found by the police, both next to Mary's head. The other 2 were never found. Frank had always emphatically claimed that the notes were a mystery to him. Be with us again next time when we present the next chapter of The Secret Relationship Between Blacks and Jews, Volume 3. The Leo Frank Case, The Lynching of a Guilty Man. Prepared by the Historical Research Department of the Nation of Islam, Chicago, Illinois. Copyright 2016 by Latimer Associates. All rights reserved. Published in audiobook form by the American Mercury with permission of the Historical Research Department of the Nation of Islam.